All right, y'all, welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I'm the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and the brand new Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism. And I've recorded more than 5,500 interviews since 2003, almost all on foreign policy, and all available for you at scotthorton.org. You can sign up for the podcast feed there, and the full interview archive is also available at youtube.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, you guys, on the line again, the first time in quite some time, I've got our old friend Nick Turse. He, of course, is the author of Kill Anything That Moves, about the war in Vietnam. And he has this really important new series at The Intercept about Henry Kissinger called Blood on His Hands. Welcome back to the show, Nick. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Very happy to have you here, Mr. Hard to get a hold of, I'll tell you what. But man, you do good work, and we follow every little bit of it over at antiwar.com. So Henry Kissinger, and you know what? David Rockefeller, his patron, too, lived to be 99. What is it with these guys? Don't tell me it's some weird thing where they drink children's blood. These people get to live to be 100 years old. It's Henry Kissinger's 100th birthday, huh? And you're reminding everybody that he ain't so nice?
Yeah. You know, I've tried to think of a fitting birthday present for Henry, and this was the best that I could come up with.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, fair. And now, look, sometimes it's hard when you want to catalog all the different people that Henry Kissinger killed that you don't know where to start, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can take your pick. You know, I asked his biographer, Greg Grandin, to give me, you know, his best guess at, you know, how much blood Kissinger had on his hands. And when you look at Southeast Asia, you look at Latin America, East Timor, Bangladesh, the number he came up with was about 3 million people, which I think is, you know, it's probably on the order of correct. So yeah, it's tough to know where to start. For my work, I went with Cambodia, but you know, there's a lot of blood on Kissinger's hands.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one thing that you point out in this piece is that he was an advisor to Kennedy and Johnson before he became Nixon's right-hand man, huh?
That's right. Yeah, he served Democratic presidents, and it looked like with Nixon's ascendancy, he had been advising Rockefeller, and you know, it looked like, you know, his political fortunes might have come to an end. But Kissinger is the ultimate survivor. I mean, as we can see, living to 100, but a political survivor as well. And he refashioned himself in the mold of Richard Nixon. And so he's served both parties.
All right, now before we get to Cambodia, I don't think you wrote about this in your book, but if you know about it, it's worth asking you. Sorry to put you on the spot, but do you know about the story of Anna Chenault and the treason of 1968?
Yeah, this was the back channel dealings to deep six the peace talks is what you're talking about, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, Kissinger had these contacts with the Johnson administration and knew about these peace talks and told the Nixon campaign. This is really how he made inroads in that campaign and eventually found his way into the Nixon White House by giving the Nixon campaign, this inside knowledge of the peace process. And, it allowed the Nixon campaign to make contact and tell the South Vietnamese to hold tight and not take any deal. So, Kissinger's responsible for widening the war in Indochina, but also for prolonging it for many years. I mean, he made certain that there wouldn't be any kind of peace, and made certain that both more Americans and more people in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos would die.
Yeah. And this is while Nixon's running on, I have a secret plan to end the war.
Exactly. Achieve peace with honor with this secret plan, which really was nothing in the way of a plan except for expanding the war, and which led to more deaths.
And there's audio of Johnson on the phone with, I forget the name of the Republican senator, and they're talking about this. And Johnson says, this is treason. They should not be doing this. But then he still didn't do anything about it or even leak it.
Yeah, he kept quiet about that, even though, you know, as you said, he recognized it as treason and stepped to see it as anything but sabotaging the diplomatic efforts of the White House at the time. But, you know, Johnson, I believe, thought it was for the good of the country that, you know, he couldn't take this public. But America and Southeast Asia suffered for it.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the war in Vietnam, Johnson really escalates the American role in 64. We'll leave out the antecedents for time's sake here. But Nixon and Kissinger come in 1969. And at this time, Kissinger's just the national security advisor, or at what time does he become Secretary of State? Not till the second term, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. At this time, he's just the national security advisor. But I say just, I mean, he wielded more power than any national security advisor before or since. He was really the architect of Nixon's policy in Southeast Asia, and really was, you know, something of a co-president in these matters. Mm-hmm. You know, he's exceptionally powerful and exceptionally hands-on when it came to the war.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, famously in your book, Kill Anything That Moves, your sourcing is almost entirely, or at least the basis of it all, is from Army investigations of their own guys' war crimes. And so this is all, you know, this new reporting is very much in that same vein, straight from the documents about the secret war in Cambodia. So can you explain to us, first of all, how it was that the war expanded to Cambodia, when, and Kissinger's role in that, and then the consequences for these poor people that you went and met for yourself?
Yes. So when, you know, Nixon, you know, he won the White House and began his term in 1969, you know, with this, you know, this secret plan, the idea to achieve peace with honor. Basically, what Henry Kissinger's plan was, you know, within the first weeks of the administration, he sat down with his military deputy, Alexander Haig, and they hatched a plan. They came up with the operation, codenamed Menu, which was kept secret from the American people, from Congress, even from top Pentagon officials. It was a bombing campaign in Cambodia that was covered up via this conspiracy of cover stories, coded messages, a dual bookkeeping system that logged strikes in that occurred in Cambodia as, you know, or that that logged airstrikes in Cambodia as occurring in South Vietnam. And, you know, Kissinger was assisted in this by a colonel from the Joint Chiefs of Staff named Ray Sitton. And Sitton would bring a list of targets to the White House for approval and maps. And Kissinger would tell him, strike here, strike there, very hands-on. So Kissinger was picking where bombs would be dropped in Cambodia, and Sitton would back-channel the coordinates into the field, circumventing the military chain of command. Then the authentic documents that were associated with these strikes were burned, and phony target coordinates and forged data were provided to the Pentagon and to Congress. So this was the beginning of the U.S. or the expansion of the U.S. war in Cambodia. Under the Johnson administration, there had been, you know, cross-border raids and you know, smaller scale attacks, but nothing on this order. It was a major expansion of the war. And, you know, we've known for decades about the secret bombing. This came out during the Watergate scandals in 1973. But I found in the National Archives, when I was doing my work on war crimes in Vietnam, a subset of records about attacks in Cambodia. And I dug further, spent hundreds of hours in the archives, finding more records that dealt with U.S. attacks, not just by these B-52 bombers, big stratofortresses, which Kissinger was had used for the secret bombing, but also smaller fighter bombers and U.S. helicopter gunships that tore up villages with their machine guns. And I had these records, and I took them and went to the ground in Cambodia. And, there I spoke with more than 75 Cambodian witnesses and survivors of US attacks and learned, new details about the long-term trauma that they suffered, and was able to document via the records and via these interviews hundreds of civilian casualties that were kept secret during the war from 1969 to 1973, and that remain almost entirely unknown to the American people. These are deaths in Cambodia that one can, tie to the very policies that Henry Kissinger championed there and helped to bring about.
Now it's interesting. Whenever you hear about the bombing of Laos, some part of it is always, involves the use of cluster bombs and the fact that people of Laos still die and are maimed by the hundreds every year by these cluster bomb units, the bombies they call them, still laying around. Is that the same case in Cambodia?
Yeah, very much so. This is something that I always ask people about, and it was the American war was still, present for them. There was still it's often children that would find these bombies. It's a little spherical piece of metal. Sometimes they were even painted a bright yellow. It looked like a toy, and children find them and start to play with them. And of course, these are decades old. They're rusted, and they can explode in an instant and cause tremendous damage. Also, in Southeast Asia, there's a thriving scrap metal trade. This is seen as a way to boost income. So sometimes children, sometimes it's adult men, but there's money to be made. Some people have gotten very good at disarming them, but these are again very, very old pieces of technology, rusted, and it's caused catastrophic damage. So sometimes people are just trying to supplement their income, and they end up becoming war casualties decades after the fact.
Yeah. Hey guys, Scott here for Leo Hamel Fine Jewelers out of San Diego at jewelrystoresd.com. They do business nationwide. They sell jewelry and watches, specializing in engagement rings. In case you're in love with somebody. They also specialize in one-of-a-kind vintage and antique jewelry, fully serviced pre-owned fine watches such as Rolex, Patek, Philippe, Cartier, and any high-end brand. Leo's also services high-end watches faster and cheaper than going to a factory service center. Leo's takes all the stress out of shopping for jewelry and engagement rings, and always at the right price. They deal nationwide over the phone at 619-299-1500. That's Leo Hamel, Fine Jewelers out of San Diego. Go to jewelrystoresd.com to check out their fine selection and to find out more. Hey, y'all, you should sign up for my Substack. It's scotthortonshow.substack.com. And if you do that, you'll get the interviews a day before everybody else. But not only that, they'll be free of commercials. How do you like that? Pretty good, huh? scotthortonshow.substack.com. Hey, y'all, LibertasBella.com is where you get Scott Horton Show and Libertarian Institute shirts, sweatshirts, mugs, and stickers and things, including the great Top Lobsters designs as well. See, that way it says on your shirt why you're so smart. Libertas Bella, from the same great folks who bring you ammo.com for all your ammunition needs, too. That's libertasbella.com.
It's such an important part of the story because, a bunch of bad stuff happened back in the days of black and white TV before I was born, Nick. But no, these people are still being exploded to death all the time. So how about we pull our troops out of everywhere and then send them in civilian clothes to go clean up these bombs? There's a use for the U.S. Army that you could actually justify right now.
You could, and there's no shortage of unexploded ordnance. Hundreds of thousands of tons we're talking about, scattered across all of Indochina. So there's plenty of work to be done by EOD technicians.
I'm sorry for this tangent, but I just have to mention that. I saw a thing on TV where they have drones with metal detectors that go around finding these undetonated bombs and charges of different kinds. They drop a tiny little shaped charge on top and then fly away and then detonate it. And for a few billion dollars, we could clean up all Southeast Asia with that. All we need is, you know, you look at all the money we're pouring into Ukraine for drones to kill people with. Here's a good use of civilian drones to clean up this mess in a way that protects human life, you know? Anyway.
Yeah, it could be done. You know, the people in Cambodia that I spoke with, you know, after the war and after the Khmer Rouge genocide, when they went back to their fields, they found all this unexploded ordnance there. Of course, they didn't have any kind of real technology. They sent young men out with just sticks to, you know, just probe and see if they hit anything. And there are a lot of young men who were, you know, who made it through the war, who then became injured afterward, just in an effort to try and clear their farm fields so that their families could eat. So it was a tremendous problem then and remains so today.
Mm. All right, now, so part of this war is just the indiscriminate fire. Kill Anything That Moves is the title of your book. It's about these so-called free fire zones where we told them to leave. So anybody still within this imaginary line and that imaginary line is you know, free to kill. And it's all jungle cover, so I have no idea who's really getting bombed down there. And you describe just these helicopter gunships and B-52s coming in, just absolutely decimating civilian populations, civilian villages, when there's not a fighter around for 10 miles or 100 at the time.
Yeah, this was the case again and again. And, you know, and it really baffled people in Cambodia, even more so than, you know, people that I spoke with in Vietnam. In Vietnam, at least people had an understanding that the war was going on, you know, that they understood the contours of the conflict. In Cambodia, these were rural farm folk in border villages who really, you know, they had no connection to the war. You know, sometimes they saw Vietnamese guerrillas, sometimes they saw American aircraft overhead, but you know, for years it didn't have much impact on their lives, and they were they didn't, you know, that the war had nothing to do with them. They were in a neutral country. They were going about their lives. Then they would say aircraft started appearing and hovering over the village. They'd never seen it, technology like this up close. They didn't know what to make of it. They came out, they stared in awe. Oftentimes they said they just didn't have any frame of reference for it. Very soon, though, those same helicopters started opening up on them with machine guns, firing rockets, incendiary rockets at their homes. And, you know, they learned to fear this machinery. And, you know, the question they had for me again and again was, why did they bomb here? Why was it done? They had no idea that the architect of their agony was Henry Kissinger. They didn't understand, you know, what caused Americans to come and why Americans came and killed their relatives and neighbors.
Mm. Now, you confronted Henry Kissinger about these civilian deaths, Nick, huh?
I did. I did my best to confront him. You know, he's very slippery, and you know, I was, yeah. It took a lot to try and track him down, but I found him at a State Department conference on the Vietnam War, and you know, he opened up after he gave a keynote address. He opened up the floor to questions, and you know, I tried to hold him to account using his own words, and you know, they took my mic away and allowed him to answer, and he basically threw up a wall of words to, you know, confuse the audience and confuse the question. And, you know, but I followed up after the talk. I sort of ran down and got into a scrum of people, mostly Kissinger sycophants who were there, who wanted to shake his hand and take pictures with him. And, you know, but I got in front of him and I asked him that question that I just mentioned, that I was asked by so many of the people I interviewed in Cambodia. But there's one woman, Mies Lorn, you know, she lost two relatives to airstrikes, and she asked me, why did they drop bombs here? And I asked that to Henry Kissinger, And, you know, he responded with sarcasm and said that, you know, I lack your intelligence and moral quality. And he also said something that was so strange. I've confronted a lot of people about war crimes over the years, but I never had a response like this. He also told me to play with it, which I thought was very odd.
What does that mean exactly?
I still don't know. He said, play with it, have a good time. And it's very, very strange. And then he stomped his cane on the floor and he stalked off. And over the next 2 days of the conference, I never saw him again. He had a very easy escape from me, but the people in the villages that I went to in Cambodia didn't have the luxury of such an easy escape.
Yeah, for real. So, man, I'm sorry we're running so short on time here, but can you talk real quick about what any of this has to do with the rise of Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge, Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan's friends?
Yeah. You know, when the U.S. started the secret bombing in Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge was a really a fringe movement, a couple thousand people at the time. But the bombing gave the Khmer Rouge just a tremendous recruiting tool. And they would go around to villages and say, you know, these bombs that are falling on your head, there's only one way that you can save your village, save Cambodia, save this country, join us, and you know, we'll be able to fight against the Americans. And you know, within a couple short years, due to that bombing, the Khmer Rouge was a 200,000 strong force. They were able to take over the country, which they plunged Cambodia into you know, this campaign of overwork and torture and murder that killed about 20% of the population, about 2 million people. And, you know, I don't think there's any way that the Khmer Rouge would have taken over without the U.S. expanding the war, without Henry Kissinger's expansion of the war into Cambodia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you say, the Americans, you know, fortunes turned very quickly. You know, by the time the Khmer Rouge took over the country and had begun their genocide, Kissinger, behind closed doors, told the Thai ambassador or his counterpart that the United States was willing to extend ties to the Khmer Rouge government. This was because they wanted to basically stick it to Vietnam. Who had just won that war against us. And he was willing to court the Khmer Rouge and throw his support behind them, back them at the United Nations. And, you know, so we backed a genocidal regime. Again, this was for power politics. This is, you know, it's been Henry Kissinger's MO his entire career. He was always willing to sacrifice people, you know, for the sake of high level power politics and diplomacy.
It's just absolutely incredible. And just for the sake of revenge, I think Noam Chomsky, I agree. I think he quite credibly said that Vietnam's invasion of Cambodia was the only legitimately humanitarian based aggressive war of one nation invading another that he could find or think of anywhere, or simply just because of the refugee crisis and because Pol Pot was killing millions of people and the Vietnamese invaded to finally put an end to this absolute horror show, this complete madhouse, this year zero policy, as crazy as anything Mao and his wife ever came up with. And then America takes Pol Pot's side just because they hate the Vietnamese for humiliating them, even though the Vietnamese are on the side of the angels in this, you know? It's just unbelievable. I mean, it's just unbelievable, yeah. You know?
Yeah. Absolutely sickening. But it's vintage Kissinger.
Yep. And then, so that really started under Ford, huh? And then Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan just continued it.
Yeah, they continued that policy. It was really, you know, Kissinger pioneered it, and they took up the mantle.
Yeah, but that had started under Ford. And isn't it interesting, as you point out, everybody gets coup d'etat right out of there during Watergate, except for Kissinger. He gets to stay for the Ford administration for the continuity in foreign policy there.
Yeah, Kissinger is the ultimate survivor. I mean, the swirl of Watergate took down almost everyone in the Nixon administration. But Kissinger, I mean, he was always really adept at playing the press. And, you know, he was able to slip free. It's another hallmark of his career. And I think a reason why, you know, right now, you know, I have this report out about him and his war crimes, but most of the coverage you see of Kissinger now is, you know, lauding him for, you know, his longevity on his 100th birthday.
Mm. And for being one click to the left of the neocons or whatever war they're trying to start. Or maybe it's one click to the right now, how you measure that. I'm so sorry that we're out of time, man. Can we talk again about Africa sometime soon?
Yeah, definitely. Let's talk again.
Okay, great, man. Well, listen, you're a great journalist. I sure love reading all that you write, and I really appreciate your time on the show, Nick.
Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right, you guys, that's Nick Terse. He's at The Intercept, and the series is called Kissinger's Killing Fields, and that includes Blood on His Hands, the notorious 1973 attack killed many more than previously known. U.S. blamed the press for military looting in Cambodia. That's an interesting one there. Completely ridiculous. And transcripts of Kissinger's calls reveal his culpability. All great stuff there at The Intercept.
The Scott Horton Show, anti-war radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.